So you open up your social media feed, right? And what do you see? There is a very high probability you're going to see some wellness
Oh,
influencer.
absolutely. The algorithm loves it.
Yeah, exactly. They're standing in this like perfectly sunlit forest, holding a mushroom or maybe a vial of some plant extract.
Looking very profoundly into the camera.
Right, looking deeply into the camera and telling you that if you take this substance, you're going to literally grow brand new brain cells.
It's everywhere.
It is everywhere. It's pitched as this ultimate biological reset button. You know, this promise that you can just sprout a whole new mind from scratch and leave your old traumatized or depressed brain completely behind.
I mean, it is an incredibly seductive narrative, right? Human psychology is just deeply, deeply drawn to that archetype of rebirth.
Yeah, the blank slate.
Exactly, a fresh start. If someone is suffering, if their mind feels broken or just stuck in a rut, the concept of manufacturing shiny factory new neurons is it's a profound comfort. It sounds like a literal cure.
And it is completely wrong. Or, well, at the very least, it's a massive distortion that has entirely outrun the actual
Oh,
science.
totally. The marketing is miles ahead of the biology.
Right. And I was reading this piece in the OATW Journal recently that tackles this exact myth head on. And that's our mission for today's deep
It's a
dive.
great piece.
It really is. The authors look at the actual data behind this ubiquitous claim, this idea that psychedelics manufacture brand new neurons, and they pit it against what is actually happening under the microscope.
Which is, spoiler alert, very different.
Very different. The article is called "Do Psychedelics Grow New Brain Cells? Neurogenesis versus Neuroplasticity." And the reality they uncover, it isn't a disappointment, right? It doesn't mean these substances aren't doing something profound.
Not at all. If anything, it's cooler.
Yeah, it reveals a biological mechanism that is much stranger, vastly more precise, and frankly, like a lot more impressive than just stamping out new cells on an assembly line.
And getting this specific biological distinction right, it's basically the entire foundation for understanding the future of mental health treatment.
Okay, let's unpack this because why does the distinction matter so much?
Well, we're not just debating semantics here, or just being pedantic about scientific vocabulary. When you understand what is actually physically happening inside the skull when these molecules enter the brain, it changes absolutely everything about how we understand therapeutic healing.
Right.
If we operate on the false assumption that we're just growing new cells, we fundamentally misunderstand the work required to heal.
So we really need to completely dismantle the new cells narrative for you listening. And to do that, we have to look at these two biological concepts that get constantly conflated in the public sphere.
Neurogenesis and neuroplasticity.
Exactly. The first is neurogenesis, the second is neuroplasticity. The internet treats these words as like interchangeable
Which
synonyms.
drives neuroscientists crazy.
I bet, because they are not. They are entirely different biological processes. So let's start with the one that influencers love, right? Neurogenesis. What is the literal definition of this process?
So, neurogenesis is the literal birth of genuinely new neurons from neural stem cells.
Okay.
To understand this, you really have to look at early human development. When a human embryo is developing in the womb, neurogenesis is occurring at this explosive, almost incomprehensible rate.
Just churning them out.
Exactly. The body is rapidly transforming undifferentiated stem cells into specialized brain cells, essentially laying down the massive physical infrastructure of the central nervous system.
Wow.
Billions upon billions of new cells are being born. They're migrating to their designated spots and they're physically forming the brain.
So it is the ultimate construction site. Like the raw materials are arriving, the foundations are being poured, and completely new structures are just rising out of the dirt every single day.
That is the perfect way to look at it. The developing brain is dedicating a massive amount of metabolic energy to sheer construction. But here is the critical shift.
Okay.
Once you reach adulthood, that process doesn't just slow down. It essentially grinds to a halt.
Really, just stops.
Practically, yeah.
Yeah.
In adult mammals, humans included, the brain shifts its metabolic priorities from building new hardware to operating and refining the hardware it already has. Adult neurogenesis becomes extremely rare.
But it doesn't stop entirely, though, right? I mean, there is a very specific area where the source material says it still happens.
Right, it doesn't stop entirely, but it becomes highly, highly restricted. In the adult mammalian brain, the birth of brand new neurons is largely confined to one specific, tiny, like comma-shaped region deep inside the hippocampus.
Which is called the dentate gyrus, right?
Yes, the dentate gyrus.
And just for context, the hippocampus is that seahorse-shaped structure in the center of the brain that deals heavily with memory and spatial navigation. So within that structure, there is this tiny subregion, the dentate gyrus, acting as kind of the last remaining nursery for new brain cells.
Yes, and honestly, for a very long time, the absolute dogma in neuroscience was that adult brains simply did not grow new neurons at all, period.
Like zero.
Zero. The scientific consensus was that you were born with all the neurons you would ever have, and you just slowly lost them over your lifetime.
Which is a depressing thought.
Very. But we now know that is not entirely true. Some new cells are born in that tiny dentate gyrus nursery.
Mm.
But it's a highly localized, relatively slow, and incredibly difficult process to measure.
Okay, so we are talking about a microscopic trickle of new cells in a very specific location, not this widespread renewal of the brain's cortex.
Exactly, it's a trickle.
So when a wellness guru claims a mushroom is going to give you a, quote, new brain, they're taking this. That's the myth. Now let's look at the reality. The OOTW journal article points out that the real magic lies in the second term, neuroplasticity.
Right.
And specifically, structural neuroplasticity. So if neurogenesis is building a new house, what is structural plasticity?
Structural neuroplasticity is all about the existing architecture. No new cells are born. The total number of neurons in your head stays exactly the same.
Okay.
Instead, the neurons you already have dramatically remodel themselves. You have to picture a neuron, right? It isn't just a round ball of biological material.
Right away, it looks more like a tree.
Exactly, like a tree. It has a central cell body, which you can think of as the trunk. And radiating out from that trunk is this massive, sprawling canopy of branches. These branches are called dendrites.
And these branches are how the neuron receives signals from other neurons around it.
Yes. And along these dendritic branches are tiny microscopic knobs or protrusions called spines.
Spines.
And these spines are the crucial locations where synapses form. A synapse is the connection point where one neuron chemically talks to another neuron.
Got it.
So when we talk about structural plasticity, we're talking about this existing tree rapidly sprouting new dendritic branches. And on those new branches, it grows an abundance of new spines.
Okay, I want to make sure I am visualizing this clearly. If I have a specific neuron in my prefrontal cortex, structural plasticity means that same neuron suddenly grows a thicker, wider canopy with thousands of new microscopic leaves, the spines reaching out to touch the trees next to it.
Yes.
So it's structurally modifying its shape to connect with more of its neighbor.
That captures the biology perfectly. The hardware was already there, but the communication network is being radically upgraded.
Wow.
And this remodeling effect is so profound and happens so robustly with these specific psychedelic substances that the scientific community actually realized their existing terminology just wasn't adequate.
Really? They needed a new word.
Yeah. In 2018, a researcher named David Olson actually coined a completely new term to describe these molecules. He called them psychoplastogens.
Psychoplastogens, that is a heavy word. Break down the etymology there for us.
Sure. So psycho refers to the mind. Plasto comes from the Greek for molding or shaping, which is the root of plasticity. And gen means producing or generating.
Okay.
So a psychoplastogen is a molecule that produces the molding and shaping of the mind. Olson and his colleagues introduced this term to forcefully shift the scientific classification of these drugs.
They wanted to rebrand them, basically.
Exactly. They wanted to reflect that the primary defining driving feature of these molecules is structural remodeling of existing networks, not the birth of new cells.
To bring this back to our earlier metaphor, if neurogenesis is trying to build a brand new computer factory inside your head, pouring a new foundation, getting zoning permits, bringing in raw steel that takes massive energy and space that an adult brain just doesn't have.
Right, it's too much.
But structural neuroplasticity is like taking an existing computer that is already sitting on your desk and suddenly wiring it with thousands of new high-speed fiber optic cables so it can communicate with every other computer in the building at lightning speed.
Yeah.
You didn't build a new computer, but the processing power of the network just exploded.
And that explosion of processing power, the sheer density of those new fiber optic cables, changes the computational capacity of the entire system. That is what is happening in the neural networks.
But I keep coming back to a psychological question here. If remodeling existing cells is this powerful, right? If upgrading the network is this revolutionary for processing trauma or depression, why are we as a society so obsessed with the exact phrase, new brain cells?
It's a great question.
Why does that specific combination of words have such a grip on the public imagination? Is it just that it sounds cleaner? Does new cells just sell more expensive wellness retreats than structural neuroplasticity?
I mean, it absolutely sells more retreats, but it taps into something deeper than just marketing.
Like what?
Well, neuroplasticity implies that you have to work with the brain you already have. You have to remodel the house you currently live in rather than just buying a brand new one and moving out of the old one. And remodeling is messy. It means tearing down drywall while you're still trying to cook dinner in the kitchen. It implies work, integration, and dealing with the existing foundation, which, might be cracked or flawed.
Right, it sounds like effort.
Exactly. The phrase new brain cells offers an escape fantasy. It implies that the damaged parts of yourself can simply be bypassed or replaced by pure, untainted biology.
Just a clean slate without doing the work.
But biologically, working with the existing architecture is the only way forward. And as the scientific evidence demonstrates, that remodeling process is incredibly robust.
Which brings us perfectly to that evidence. We have established what structural plasticity is in theory. Let's look at what the strongest science actually says these psychoplastogens are doing to those existing fiber optic cables.
The data is amazing.
The data that OOTW Journal highlights is genuinely astonishing. Where does the modern foundational proof for this actually start?
The modern foundation really crystallizes with that 2018 study out of David Olson's lab, specifically a paper led by researcher Calvin Lai. They were looking at serotonergic psychedelics, molecules like LSD, DMT, and DOI,
Okay.
and they wanted to observe the physical architecture of the neurons after exposure to these drugs.
And just to set the stage for where they were looking, they were focusing on cortical neurons, right? This isn't the tiny dentate gyrus nursery anymore.
No, this is crucial. They were looking at the cortex, particularly areas like the prefrontal cortex.
Right.
This is the outer layer of the brain, the highly evolved, folded gray matter that is responsible for complex cognitive behavior, personality expression, decision making, and moderating social behavior.
The command center.
It is the command center. And what Olson's team found was definitive. These classic psychedelics actively increase the physical complexity of the dendritic branches in these cortical neurons.
So they could actually see it.
Yes. They saw a measurable increase in the density of the spines, those synaptic connection points, and a subsequent increase in the total number of synapses. The neurons were visibly morphing into more complex, more highly connected structures.
So they basically proved that the psychoplastogen concept was real. The molecules were molding the physical shape of the cells.
Exactly.
But science always wants a closer look. That was 2018. The article then points to a study 3 years later, in 2021, that seems like a massive leap forward in how we actually visualize this
Oh,
process.
yeah.
It was from Alex Kwan's group, a paper published in the journal Neuron by Ling Xiaoxiao and colleagues.
The Kwan study is a landmark moment because of the methodology they used. They utilized a technology called two-photon microscopy.
Okay, I was reading about this in the source material, and I have to admit, it sounds like absolute science fiction.
It kind of is.
I understand microscopes where you put a dead slide of tissue on a glass plate, shine a light under it, and look through a lens.
Yeah.
But how does two-photon microscopy work, and why is it such a big deal for this specific question?
Standard microscopy is great for looking at dead sliced tissue. But if you want to understand how a living brain changes over time, dead tissue is useless.
Because it's not changing anymore.
Right. Two-photon microscopy allows scientists to look directly into the brain of a living, breathing, behaving creature, in this case, laboratory mice.
Wow.
They surgically create a tiny transparent window in the mouse's skull. Then, using highly advanced, ultra-fast, pulsing infrared lasers, they can excite fluorescent proteins that have been introduced into specific neurons.
That is wild.
The physics of it allows them to penetrate deeper into living tissue without scattering the light or instantly frying the cells.
I want you to stop and think about the reality of that for a second. The scientist is looking through a microscopic window into a living brain.
Yeah.
They aren't looking at a snapshot of a dead cell. They are watching a living neural network function in real time. They can find a specific neuron, map its branches, take a picture of its exact structure on a Monday, and then come back to that exact same living cell on a Tuesday to see if it changed.
It's incredible. It allows for longitudinal tracking of individual synapses. So in this study, they mapped the dendritic spines in the living mice. Then they administered a single dose of psilocybin.
One single dose.
One dose. They waited 24 hours, and they looked back through that cranial window at the exact same neurons they had mapped the day before.
And what did they see?
What they observed was a staggering biological shift. Within that 24-hour window, the dendritic spine density on those specific neurons had increased by roughly 10%.
10% in a single day. A living cell in the command center of the brain grew 10% more communication nodes overnight.
Yes. The structural complexity of the network expanded massively in a 24-hour period. But, you know, the researchers didn't stop there.
Right, because rapid growth is interesting. But if those new spines disappear the next day, it doesn't mean much for long-term therapeutic healing.
Exactly. So they kept looking through the window. They tracked those exact same living mice days later and then weeks later.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found was that a month after that single dose of psilocybin, those newly grown spines were still present.
Wow.
The changes were durable.
I am trying to contextualize how wild that is compared to the tools we normally use in psychiatry. If someone goes to a doctor for severe depression today, they are typically prescribed an SSRI, right? A selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, something like Lexapro or Zoloft.
That's the standard of care, yeah.
How does this 10% overnight growth compare to what an SSRI does?
It is an entirely different paradigm of action. Traditional SSRIs do promote neuroplasticity that is actually believed to be a major part of how they eventually relieve depression. But the mechanism is indirect, incredibly slow, and much less pronounced.
Okay, so how does it work?
When you take an SSRI, it alters the serotonin levels in the synaptic cleft. And over a period of weeks or even months, this sustained chemical change slowly coaxes the brain into subtle structural remodeling.
Which is why it takes so long to feel it.
That is exactly why patients are told they won't feel the effects of an antidepressant for 4 to 6 weeks. The structural changes take that long to accumulate.
Wow.
With a psychoplastogen like psilocybin, the researchers were watching massive, robust structural growth happen in 24 hours. It is rapid, it is real, and it persists long after the drug has left the body.
It is like you go to sleep in your house, and when you wake up the next morning, a construction crew has flawlessly installed a whole new wing on the house, fully wired with electricity and plumbing.
Yes.
And a month later, you check the foundation of that new wing, and it hasn't settled, it hasn't cracked, it is just permanently part of your house now.
It's just there.
But as I was reading this section of the OOTW Journal article, a massive, glaring question popped into my head.
Oh, I bet I know what it is.
Psilocybin, LSD, DMT, these are all classified as serotonergic psychedelics, meaning their primary target is the serotonin system, specifically the 5-HT2A receptor. But wait a minute. You and I, and everyone listening, naturally have serotonin floating around in our brains all the time. It is a fundamental neurotransmitter.
It is.
If these drugs are just hitting the same serotonin receptors that our natural serotonin hits, why doesn't our own natural built-in serotonin make our brains sprout 10% more branches every single day?
Right.
Why do we need a complex fungal molecule to trigger this massive growth?
That is the exact paradox that has haunted neuroscientists in this field. It makes no intuitive sense.
Because it's the same receptor.
Right. If natural serotonin and a drug like LSD both bind to the exact same receptor, the 5-HT2A receptor,
right.
Why does the drug cause explosive overnight structural growth while the natural serotonin just quietly regulates normal daily mood and sleep cycles?
Right.
Why the radically different outcome from the same receptor?
Right.
The answer to that question was entirely unknown until very recently. And it leads us into one of the most surprising and elegant molecular twists in cellular biology.
This is the part of the article that completely hooked me. It is based on a 2023 paper by David Olson's lab, led by Vargas and colleagues, published in the journal Science.
Brilliant paper.
And the entire mystery of why psychedelics work and natural serotonin doesn't, it all comes down to a microscopic game of VIP access inside the cell itself, based on one simple chemical property, fat versus water.
It is a brilliant piece of cellular detective work. To understand it, we have to look at the physical boundary of the neuron itself.
Okay, let's look at the boundary.
Every single neuron in your brain is encased in an outer membrane. That membrane is a lipid bilayer. In simple terms, it is a wall made of fat.
Right.
It is designed that way to protect the cell, to keep the internal machinery in and the external environment out.
Because oil and water don't mix.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, our natural endogenous serotonin is what chemists call hydrophilic. It is water-loving or water-soluble. Because it is water-soluble, it cannot easily pass through the fatty lipid wall of the neuron. It physically bounces off. Therefore, natural serotonin has to stay on the outside of the cell, in the extracellular space.
So it's stuck out there.
Yes. It does its job by interacting only with the receptors that are sticking out on the surface of the cell membrane.
Okay, so think of the cell membrane as the bouncer at an incredibly exclusive, high-end nightclub. The inside of the cell is the club.
I like this.
Natural serotonin is water-soluble, so it's not on the VIP list. The bouncer keeps it outside on the street. It can talk to the bouncer. It can pass messages through the door by hitting the surface receptors, but it is physically barred from stepping foot inside the club.
That is a highly accurate analogy. Serotonin signals from the outside in. Now, look at the chemical structure of classic psychedelics like LSD or psilocybin.
Okay.
They are lipophilic. They are fat-soluble.
Oh.
They are on the VIP list.
Yeah.
They show up. They were wearing the right jacket. They slip right past the fatty membrane bouncer, and they walk straight through the front door into the interior of the club. Precisely. Because they are fat-soluble, they bypass the outer membrane almost entirely and diffuse straight into the interior of the neuron.
Wow.
And here is the massive revelation from the Vargas study. The researchers discovered that there is a huge, hidden, internal pool of these five HT2A receptors located inside the neuron.
So there are more receptors on the inside?
Yes. Natural serotonin cannot reach them because it is stuck outside on the street. But the psychedelic molecules slip right inside the cell, bind to those hidden internal receptors, and that internal activation is what triggers the massive structural growth cascade.
That is biologically mind-blowing. Evolution basically hid the master growth switch inside the cell behind a locked fatty door that our own natural daily chemicals can't easily open.
It's quite elegant.
It really is, because it prevents our brains from constantly chaotically growing new connections every time we get a spike in normal serotonin. It keeps the system stable. But nature created these complex plant and fungal molecules that just so happen to possess the exact right lipophilic VIP pass to slide through the wall and hit the hidden switch.
That's biology for you.
And as if that wasn't complicated enough, the OTW Journal points out that the serotonin receptor might not even be the only VIP switch they are hitting. There is a whole other layer to this that just emerged, right? The TRKB connection.
Yes, the plot continues to thicken. While the intracellular 5-HT2A receptor story is compelling, another major study came out in 2023 that shook the field again.
It's all happening so recently.
Very recently. This was from Eero Castrén's lab in Finland, led by Molinar and colleagues, published in Nature Neuroscience. They found that LSD and psilocybin do not just act on the serotonin system.
Okay, what else do they do?
They actually bind directly to an entirely different receptor called TRKB, and they bind to it with an incredibly high affinity, a much stronger grip than standard antidepressant medications.
I'm going to need you to unpack TRKB, because I see that acronym everywhere in this literature. Why does it matter that psychedelics are grabbing on to TRKB?
TRKB is profoundly important because it is the specific cellular receptor for BDNF. BDNF stands for brain-derived neurotrophic factor. If you want to understand neuroplasticity, you have to understand BDNF.
Okay, what is it?
It is essentially Miracle-Gro for the brain. It is the master growth protein that signals neurons to survive, grow, and differentiate. Normally, the brain secretes BDNF, which binds to TRKB, which tells the cell to grow.
So normally, BDNF is the key for the TRKB lock.
Exactly. But the Castrén lab demonstrated that psychedelics can bypass the need for BDNF entirely and bind directly to TRKB themselves, forcefully activating the growth signal.
So we have two different potential entry points here. The psychedelic is either slipping inside the cell to hit the hidden internal serotonin receptors, or it is directly grabbing onto the TRKB receptor. But regardless of which switch it flips, what is the ultimate result inside the neuron? Once the VIP switch is thrown, what actually happens in the cellular assembly line to build those new spines in 24 hours?
This is where the sheer elegance of cellular biology shines. Both of these distinct entry points, the internal 5-HT2A and the TRKB receptor, trigger the exact same downstream molecular cascade.
Okay.
The signal travels down a chemical pathway and ultimately activates a massive protein complex called MTOR.
I know MTOR. You hear about MTOR constantly in longevity podcasts, fasting protocols, and weightlifting circles. It regulates muscle growth and cellular aging.
It does.
What is it doing in the brain?
MTOR stands for a mammalian target of rapamycin, and it is a central, highly conserved hub for cellular metabolism and growth across the entire body. Think of MTOR as the master general contractor for the cell.
Okay, the general contractor.
When MTOR is inactive, the cell is just maintaining its current state. But when MTOR gets the signal from the psychedelic, it goes into overdrive.
So it starts building.
Yes. It immediately orders the trafficking of AMPA receptors to the cell membrane, and it kicks off heavy, rapid protein synthesis. It literally commands the cell's machinery to take raw amino acids and physically construct the structural scaffolding required to build those new dendritic spines we talked about earlier.
So it is marshaling the raw materials and building the new fiber optic cables in real time.
Exactly.
And here is a wild piece of evidence the article brings up to prove that MTOR is the master contractor. What happens when we look at ketamine? Because ketamine is not a classic psychedelic.
Not at all.
It doesn't look like LSD or psilocybin chemically, and it does not act on the serotonin system at all. Yet it causes the exact same rapid structural growth. How is that possible?
This is a phenomenon scientists call convergent rapid plasticity. Ketamine enters the brain and does something completely different. It blocks a receptor called the NMDA receptor.
Okay.
The NMDA receptor normally acts as a gatekeeper for electrical signals. When ketamine blocks it, the brain responds by releasing a massive surge of a different neurotransmitter called glutamate.
And glutamate is?
Glutamate is the brain's primary excitatory chemical. This massive glutamate surge creates a wave of activity that, eventually, forces the release of BDNF, which hits TRKB. And what does TRKB activate?
MTOR.
R, exactly. The glutamate surge eventually reaches the exact same BDNF to TRKB to MTOR endpoint.
Let me make sure I am fully wrapping my head around this convergent plasticity concept because it's so cool. You have this central master growth machinery deep inside the cell, the MTOR system.
Right.
It is the general contractor sitting there, fully capable of building new synaptic connections, but waiting for authorization. Evolution built this incredible engine.
Yes.
And modern science has essentially found two entirely different chemical keys that can start that same engine.
Perfectly said.
Classic psychedelics are one key. They use their fat-soluble properties to slip through the membrane, hit the hidden serotonin switch, and turn on MTOR.
Uh-huh.
Ketamine is a completely different key. It kicks down a different door by blocking NMDA, floods the system with a glutamate surge, and that wave ultimately turns on MTOR. Different doors, different keys, but they end up in the exact same room, flipping the exact same master switch, resulting in the exact same rapid explosion of new neural connections.
That is the brilliant synthesis of the modern psychoplastogen hypothesis. Mm-hmm. The mechanism of entry is different, but the cellular endpoint is identical.
Okay, so let's pause and survey the landscape here. We have mapped out an undeniable, highly robust, scientifically airtight case for structural rewiring.
We have.
We have the two-photon microscopy, proving the spines grow in living brains and stick around for a month. We have the molecular cascades mapped out to the letter from the lipophilic membrane crossing to the TRKB binding, all the way down to MTOR protein synthesis.
It's all there.
So if the evidence for structural remodeling is this overwhelming and precise, where in the world did the new cells rumor start?
Oh, man.
Right. Why is the internet absolutely convinced that neurogenesis is the main event? It turns out, as with most persistent scientific myths, there is a tiny grain of truth to it. But as we look at the actual studies that claim psychedelics cause neurogenesis, we are going to see that the reality is incredibly, incredibly messy.
It is the definition of messy, contested science.
Yeah.
The evidence for literal neurogenesis, the birth of genuinely new neurons after psychedelic exposure, does exist in the literature. But when you compare it to the mountain of pristine data for plasticity, the neurogenesis data is thin, contradictory, and mostly relegated to preclinical animal models or like isolated cells floating in a petri dish.
So not a sure thing at all.
Not even close. And when you look closely at those animal studies, the clean narrative of take mushrooms, get new cells falls apart instantly.
Okay, let's look at the specific psilocybin study the OOTW article cites. This is a 2013 mouse study by Catlow and colleagues. When I read the results of this study, I actually laughed out loud because it completely contradicts the heroic dose podcast bro culture that dominates the internet right now.
It really does.
What did the researchers actually find when they gave my psilocybin and then counted the new brain cells in their hippocampus?
They found a phenomenon called dose-dependent opposite effects. This means the result completely flipped, depending on how much drug they gave.
Wow. Okay.
When they administered very low doses of psilocybin to the mice, they did see a slight trend toward an increase in the creation of new neurons in the hippocampus.
Okay, so a microdose might cause a tiny bump in neurogenesis, but what happened when they increased the dose to mimic a full psychedelic trip?
When they gave the mice high doses, the equivalent of a strong, behaviorally active psychedelic experience, it actually decreased the number of newborn neurons compared to the control group. High doses suppressed neurogenesis.
Wait, I really want to underline this. If someone listens to a wellness influencer, goes to a retreat, and takes a massive high dose of psilocybin based on the specific, heavily cited mouse study, they might actually be temporarily shutting down or reducing the very neurogenesis that the influencer promised they were boosting. That is the exact mathematical opposite of the popular narrative.
It directly contradicts the popular claim. And furthermore, the Catlow study looked at the behavioral benefits in the mice.
Okay, what did they test?
They tested the mice on how fast they could extinguish a conditioned fear response. Fear extinction is basically a biological proxy for overcoming trauma. The mouse learns that a previously scary stimulus is no longer dangerous.
Got it.
The researchers found that the behavioral benefits, the overcoming of the fear, did not track neatly with the neuron counts at all.
Meaning, the mice were getting over their trauma, but it wasn't because they had a bunch of brand new cells. The new cells weren't the driving force behind the healing.
Precisely. The structural rewiring of existing cells was doing the heavy lifting, while the birth of new cells was fluctuating wildly based on dosage and didn't clearly correlate with the psychological benefit. However, the source material does point out one genuine anomaly in the literature that keeps the neurogenesis hope alive. In 2020, a researcher named Morales Garcia published a paper investigating DMT, the active compound in ayahuasca.
Oh, what did they find with DMT? Because ayahuasca is legendary for its psychological reset properties.
The Morales Garcia study showed that DMT actually did stimulate neural stem cells to proliferate and become new neurons, both in a petri dish and in living mice.
Okay, so there is some truth there.
It is a very real, robust finding. But here is the critical caveat that gets lost in the headlines. The biological mechanism is entirely different.
How so?
DMT did not promote new neurons through the 5-HT2A serotonin pathway that drives all the spine growth we just talked about. It stimulated neurogenesis through an entirely different receptor system called the sigma-1 receptor.
So it's a completely separate biological story. Yes, DMT hitting the sigma-1 receptor might promote some new cell birth, but that is a distinct parallel mechanism to the massive, widespread structural remodeling happening via the serotonin and MTOR pathways.
Exactly. It's parallel, not the main event.
It is an intriguing piece of the puzzle, but it doesn't support a universal claim that all psychedelics grow new brain cells.
Right.
But the article brings up an even larger, much more existential debate in the scientific community that makes this whole neurogenesis conversation feel almost irrelevant. And this genuinely blew my mind.
Oh, this is the best part.
The entire internet claim that psychedelics grow new brain cells in humans requires one massive fundamental assumption to be true: that adult humans actually grow new brain cells in the hippocampus in the first place. But neuroscientists aren't even sure that is a real phenomenon.
This is a perfect illustration of how science operates on the bleeding edge. The public thinks science is a static book of settled facts.
Right, like we just know these things.
In reality, it is an active, ongoing, and sometimes fiercely debated process. In 2018, the exact same year David Olson was proving structural plasticity and coining the term psychoplastogens, the neuroscience world was rocked by an existential debate over human neurogenesis.
What happened?
Two major, highly respected teams of researchers published massive papers looking at the exact same question. Does neurogenesis continue to happen in the adult human hippocampus? And they reached completely 100% opposite conclusions.
I am fascinated by how that even happens at the highest levels of science. How can two teams of top-tier scientists look at human brains and see completely different biological realities?
It comes down to the extreme technical difficulty of studying human brains. You cannot put a living human under a two-photon microscope.
Right, that would be frowned upon.
Highly. You cannot genetically engineer their neurons to glow green. If you want to study human neurogenesis, you have to use post-mortem tissue. You have to wait for people to donate their brains to science after they die, and then you slice the hippocampus and look for microscopic chemical markers that indicate a cell was recently born.
Okay, so what did the first team find?
The first paper, published in the journal Nature by Arturo Alvarez Boya's lab, led by Sorrells and colleagues, looked in an extensive library of these postmortem human brains. They meticulously searched for the markers of new neurons. And their conclusion was devastating to the neurogenesis field. They stated that the production of new neurons drops sharply in childhood and falls to virtually undetectable levels in adults. They essentially concluded that adult human neurogenesis does not exist in any meaningful way.
Wow. So they looked at the brains of adults and concluded the factory is closed, the lights are off, the machinery has been dismantled, there are no new cells being born here.
Yes. It was a massive blow. But then, just a few weeks later, a different team led by Mauro Boldrini at Columbia University published a paper in Cell Stem Cell.
Let me guess. Completely different finding.
They looked at a different set of postmortem human brains. They used slightly different chemical preservation techniques. And their conclusion was the exact opposite. They claimed that human hippocampal neurogenesis persists steadily throughout aging, right into our latest years of life.
So one Ivy League team says the factory is abandoned, and another Ivy League team says the factory is still pumping out fresh cells every single day.
The discrepancy likely comes down to the extreme fragility of the evidence. How quickly was the brain tissue preserved after the person died? What specific chemical antibodies did they use to identify the new cells? How fast do those chemical markers degrade over time in a jar of formaldehyde?
So many variables.
The debate is incredibly nuanced, deeply technical, and frankly, it remains unresolved today. The field is split.
Which brings us to the profound implication of the OOTW Journal article. The entire wellness internet is running around confidently shouting that psychedelics grow new brain cells in humans. But that massive therapeutic claim requires a biological foundation, adult human neurogenesis, that the top neuroscientists in the world cannot even agree exists.
It's crazy when you think about it.
It is like arguing over what brand of high-performance tires you are going to put on a car when half the mechanics are standing in the garage arguing over whether the car itself is real.
It is scientifically irresponsible to build massive clinical claims on an unproven substrate. That is exactly why serious researchers focus their energy on neuroplasticity. We know, unequivocally, that neuroplasticity happens in adults. We know the neurons are physically there in the cortex, and we can prove they grow new connections. It is a measurable, actionable reality.
Okay, so let's follow that logic. If looking directly into a living human brain to count neurons or measure microscopic spines is basically impossible, scientists have had to look for workarounds to prove this plasticity is happening in patients.
Right.
They have tried to look for clues in the blood, the thinking goes. If the brain is undergoing a massive structural remodel, maybe it leaves a chemical trace in the bloodstream that we can measure with a simple blood test. But as the article details, the blood might be lying to us.
This brings us to what I consider the biomarker illusion.
The biomarker illusion.
Yep. In modern medicine, humans are obsessed with objective data. We want a number on a page. And since BDNF, that brain-derived neurotrophic factor, the Miroglobin protein we discussed, is at the absolute center of the cellular plasticity cascade. Every researcher and every pharmaceutical company developing these drugs wants to use BDNF as the ultimate biomarker.
Because it would be so easy.
The dream is beautiful in its simplicity. A patient comes into a clinic with severe depression. You give them a psychedelic.
Yeah.
The next day, you draw their blood. You see a massive spike in BDNF levels. And you say, aha, look at the lab work. Your brain is physically rewiring itself right now. The treatment is working.
We crave that certainty. We don't want to just rely on a patient sitting in a chair and subjectively saying, I think I feel a little better today. Mm. We want hard, undeniable molecular proof to validate the experience. But what happens when researchers actually test the human blood for BDNF after administering these powerful psychoplastogens?
The reality check is harsh, and it is a frustrating hurdle for the field. The human blood data is incredibly weak, widely inconsistent, and full of noise.
Huh.
Early on, there was a small study that showed a transient, minor rise in blood BDNF after a low dose of LSD. Mm-hmm. People got excited. But when other teams ran direct, head-to-head clinical trials using full therapeutic doses of both LSD and psilocybin, the results vanished.
Wow.
The drugs did not reliably or consistently raise plasma BDNF levels in the patients.
And the source material highlights a massive, definitive meta-analysis that just came out, right? That seems to put the nail in the coffin.
Yes. The definitive blow to the BDNF biomarker dream came in a 2024 meta-analysis published in the journal Molecular Psychiatry. A meta-analysis is where researchers gather all the data from dozens of individual studies and throw it into a massive statistical blender to see if a true signal survives the noise.
Right, the gold standard.
They looked at 29 different studies measuring the effects of psychoplastogens, including classic psychedelics and ketamine, on blood BDNF levels in humans. Their conclusion was unambiguous. They found no overall effect.
Zero.
Zero consistent, reliable increase in peripheral blood BDNF after taking these drugs.
Wait, I am struggling to reconcile this. We know for an absolute fact from the 2-photon microscopy in mice that BDNF is driving massive, explosive spine growth in the brain. The structural changes are physically happening.
Undeniably.
So how can the protein responsible for it not be showing up in the blood? Where is the BDNF hiding?
This is a crucial lesson in human biology and anatomy. A peripheral blood test, drawing blood from a vein in your arm, is an incredibly poor, noisy window into the brain. It is trying to measure rapid, microscopic, highly localized cellular changes happening deep inside the architecture of the cortex.
Okay.
And the brain is separated from the rest of the body by an intense security system known as the blood-brain barrier.
Ah, right. The blood-brain barrier. It's a highly protected, tightly sealed cellular wall that surrounds the blood vessels in the brain, right? It stops pathogens and toxins in the blood from leaking into the brain tissue.
Yes. It is a highly isolated, privileged environment. Just because an intense localized symphony of protein synthesis and spine growth is happening in a specific micrometer of the prefrontal cortex does not mean that those specific BDNF proteins are going to bypass the blood-brain barrier, flood into the general circulatory system, and show up in measurable, significant amounts in the blood circulating through your arm.
It is like there is a massive, beautiful, chaotic rock concert happening inside a completely soundproof underground bunker.
That's a great image.
You can be standing on the street right above the bunker, holding a highly sensitive microphone, trying to record the music. But because of the concrete walls, the microphone picks up nothing but the sound of passing cars and wind.
Exactly. The signal is contained.
Are we just clinging to these blood BDNF tests because we are desperate for a simple metric? It feels like that old joke where a man loses his keys in a dark alley, but he is searching for them a block away under a streetlight just because the light is better there.
The streetlight analogy perfectly captures the frustration of modern psychiatry. We measure peripheral blood because blood is easy and cheap to measure. We cannot easily or ethically open a window in a living human skull to measure their cortical spine.
Well, we cannot.
So we have to rely on inference. We map the molecular pathway meticulously in animal models. We observe the profound subjective and clinical outcomes in human patients. And we infer, with highly educated confidence, that structural plasticity is the invisible bridge connecting the two.
But we can't see the bridge in the blood.
Exactly. The OOTW Journal article is completely honest about the limits of our current technology. Human molecular confirmation via blood tests is an illusion. The structural remodeling is almost certainly happening in humans, but we cannot currently prove it with a simple blood draw.
Okay, let's step back and look at the macro picture. We have dismantled the myth. We established that the drugs are definitely not growing brand new cells. We established that we cannot easily measure the growth factor in human blood. But we know, based on the convergent animal models and the molecular cascades, that these molecules are rapidly, profoundly rewiring the synaptic connections in the cortex.
We do.
So what does this actually mean for a person's lived experience? This is the ultimate so what of the entire deep dive. Let's say I am a patient dealing with severe trauma, PTSD, or treatment-resistant depression. My brain just grew 10% more dendritic spines overnight.
Okay.
Why does sprouting new microscopic branches actually help treat complex psychological conditions? How does structural rewiring translate into emotional healing?
To bridge the gap between microscopic cellular changes and macro-level psychological healing, we have to look at some of the most groundbreaking theoretical work in neuroscience today. This comes out of Gould Dellen's lab.
Oh, I've read about her work.
It's incredible. Specifically, a sweeping 2023 paper by Nardou and colleagues published in Nature. They proposed a concept that perfectly unites the biology with the psychology. They demonstrated that psychedelics reopen what is called a window of heightened learning, or a critical period.
A critical period. I want to spend a lot of time on this concept because reading this part of the source material completely shifted my entire understanding of what mental health actually is. What exactly is a critical period in biology?
A critical period is a specific genetically programmed window of time, usually during early childhood development, when the nervous system is hypersensitive and hyperresponsive to environmental input.
Like a sponge.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It is a time when the brain is essentially acting like a highly malleable sponge, rapidly absorbing and hardwiring crucial survival, motor, and social skills. The classic, most easily understood example is language acquisition.
Right. Think about a 3-year-old child. You can drop a 3-year-old into a foreign country, surrounded by a new language, and within a year or two, their brain will effortlessly absorb the syntax, the vocabulary, and they will be speaking fluently, without an accent, without ever taking a single formal grammar lesson.
It's effortless for them.
Their brain is wide open. It is in a critical period for language. But if I, as a 30-year-old adult, move to that same country and try to learn the language, I will struggle for years, I will have to study textbooks, and I will likely always have an accent. My critical period for language has slammed shut.
And we have to ask why evolution designed it that way. Why do these windows close?
Yeah, why don't we just stay sponges?
It is a matter of biological efficiency. It takes an enormous amount of metabolic energy to keep a brain that malleable, that sensitive to every piece of input. Once a child has learned the basic rules of their environment, how to speak, how to walk, who is safe, who is dangerous, the brain needs to solidify those neural pathways to be efficient.
It kind of locks them in.
Right. It hardwires the software into permanent hardware, so you don't have to consciously relearn how to interact with the world every single morning. The pathways become rigid.
If the brain is wet cement during childhood, adulthood is when the cement dries and hardens. It is great for efficiency. You can drive a heavy truck over dry cement without leaving a mark. But the problem arises when the environment you grew up in was traumatic, or when, later in life, you develop rigid, negative patterns of thinking.
Yes. This is where we reconceptualize mental illness. Conditions like severe depression, PTSD, chronic anxiety, or addiction are often characterized by entrenched, highly rigid, inflexible neural patterns.
So they're stuck in the cement.
The brain learned a maladaptive response. Perhaps it was a necessary survival response to trauma at the time, and then the critical period closed, locking that negative pattern into the solid cement. The patient is neurologically stuck in a rut. They rationally know they shouldn't be depressed or terrified, but their neural architecture is physically wired to repeat the pattern.
So how do psychedelics interact with these closed windows? What did Gil Dullin's lab actually discover?
They found that administering psychedelics reliably reopened a juvenile critical period for social reward learning in adult mice. And they didn't just test one drug. They tested MDMA, psilocybin, LSD, ketamine, and even ibogaine.
All of them.
Across the board, these psychoplastogens forcefully pushed the adult brain back into that state of childhood hypermalleability. The drugs temporarily turned the solid concrete back into wet cement. The adult brain was granted the plasticity of a child's brain.
And there's a detail in the study that I could not get over when reading the OOTW journal. It is a detail that feels almost too perfectly designed.
I know exactly what you're going to say.
They didn't just find that the drugs opened the window. They measured how long the window stayed open. And they found that the length of time the biological plasticity window stayed open in the mice precisely scaled with the duration of the drug's subjective effects in humans. Let me make sure I am explaining this right, because it is staggering. The length of the trip directly correlates to how long the biological cement stays wet.
It is a stunning correlation that bridges pharmacology and phenomenology.
Yeah.
Let's look at the data. Ketamine produces a very short, highly transient, subjective psychological experience in humans, usually lasting about an hour or two.
Right.
In the biological models, ketamine reopened the critical period for roughly 48 hours. Psilocybin and LSD, which produce much longer subjective trips lasting anywhere from 6 to 12 hours, kept the biological window of malleability open for days or even a couple of weeks.
And then there's ibogaine.
Right. And then there's ibogaine. Ibogaine produces a massive, grueling, physically and psychologically intense experience that can last for days. Ibogaine kept the critical learning window open for weeks after a single dose.
It is poetry and biology aligning perfectly. The deeper and longer the subjective journey, the wider and longer the biological window of opportunity remains open. But this leads to the ultimate conclusion of the source material, the massive reality check about what plasticity actually is. Plasticity is not a magic fix.
No, it isn't.
Sprouting 10% more dendritic spines does not automatically cure a person's depression. Plasticity is simply a temporary state of heightened malleability. The drug itself does not cure the illness.
That is the most crucial paradigm-shifting point of this entire discussion. We have to stop viewing these molecules as traditional pharmaceuticals that fix a broken system. The drug is simply a chemical key that unlocks the door to the critical period. It hands the adult brain back a superpower it lost after childhood. But it is just an open window. It is potential energy, not kinetic energy.
Think of it like this. You have a deep, miserable rut in the concrete rate of your mind that is the depression. The psychedelic experience pours fresh, wet cement over the road. The old, rigid tracks are temporarily smoothed over. But if you take the drug, and then the next day you do absolutely nothing different, if you just go right back to scrolling on your phone, eating terrible food, ignoring your relationships, and thinking the exact same negative thoughts, you are just driving the exact same truck over the wet cement. And when the critical period closes, when the cement dries, the rut will have reformed in the exact same shape it was before.
Exactly. The drug opens the window, but the experience within that window is what dictates the healing. Integration, therapy, conscious behavioral changes, the new habits you forcefully implement while that window is open, that is what actually draws the new, healthier pathways in the cement before it hardens again. The healing is an active, demanding process. The biological plasticity merely makes the healing possible.
Which fundamentally changes how we view mental health care. It shifts the paradigm away from a passive medical model where a doctor gives you a pill to suppress a symptom and moves it toward an active learning model.
You're a participant.
You are not a passive recipient of healing. You are the architect. The drug gives you the raw building materials and the permits to remodel, but you still have to pick up the hammer and build the house.
Well said.
Okay, we have covered an incredible amount of dense, fascinating ground today. Let's trace the arc of what we've unpacked. We started by completely debunking the great wellness myth. You are not growing a whole new brain from scratch. The new cell neurogenesis narrative is a massive oversimplification of complex science.
A marketing gimmick, mostly.
Yeah. Instead, we uncovered the reality of psychoplastogens and structural neuroplasticity. We look at the astonishing evidence of 10% growth in dendritic spines that happens in just 24 hours and persists for a month. We explored the elegant intracellular twist, how fat-soluble psychedelics slip past the lipid membrane bouncer to hit hidden internal 5-HT2A receptors, triggering the master MTOR general contractor to build new synapses.
Quite the journey.
We navigated the messy reality of why blood BDNF tests are a faulty, noisy proxy that cannot capture the localized symphony in the cortex. And finally, we landed on the profound reality of critical periods that these substances reopen the childhood windows of learning, handing us the wet cement we need to actively rewire our own minds.
It is a vastly more complex, scientifically rigorous, and ultimately much more hopeful picture of how the human brain can change and adapt.
But before we sign off, I want to leave everyone listening with a final provocative thought. This is an implication drawn directly from the source text, but it is something that the influencer culture rarely, if ever, acknowledges.
What's that?
We just spent an hour establishing that psychedelics forcefully pry open a critical period of heightened learning and malleability. Your brain becomes incredibly sensitive to the environment, acting like a hyperabsorbent sponge, just like the brain of a toddler.
Which means, by definition, the brain will absorb whatever it is exposed to during that time.
Exactly. So what happens if the environment a person returns to during that open biological window is toxic? What if you have a massive psychedelic experience, your window of malleability flies wide open, and then the very next day, you go right back into a highly stressful, toxic workplace? Or you return to an emotionally abusive relationship? Or you are exposed to a sudden traumatic event while your brain is still in that state of wet cement?
This raises a profoundly important and honestly somewhat dark question for the future of clinical rollout. If the drug makes the brain uniquely susceptible to learning, then couldn't a negative environment while the window is open cause the brain to deeply hardwire negative patterns just as easily and just as deeply as positive ones?
Could you accidentally wire your trauma even deeper into your neural architecture because the cement was wet when the bad thing happened?
It's entirely possible.
It is a sobering thought, and it emphasizes exactly why the clinical and therapeutic community is so fiercely protective of concepts like set and setting, and why extensive integration therapy after the dose is so vital. The open biological window is entirely neutral. It does not inherently care what it learns. It just learns whatever is put in front of it.
It's a tool, not a savior.
So the next time you see that video on your feed, promising you a fresh batch of shiny new brain cells and an effortless biological reset, just remember that the truth is far more demanding and far more beautiful. You do not get a brand new brain. You get the rare, fleeting, and fragile opportunity to remodel the one you have.
Yeah, I couldn't say it better myself.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the architecture of the mind. Keep questioning the simple headlines, keep digging past the hype, and never stop seeking the deeper, more complex truth. We'll catch you on the next one.